I can't tell that it's working. Is there any evidence? I see no evidence.
I never record you, actually.
Yeah. You could say that with some confidence because you know I don't listen to the podcast.
I know. So you would never know because I just never...
So it's an hour and a half of you talking silent, like a few seconds
it's just,
of silence.
Yeah.
Because I don't really say much in the podcast.
No, anymore. Not at all. So... It's like just a surreal podcast. It's like Kirsten having a conversation with her imaginary friend and the reader just has to fill in the blanks.
That would be awesome. Let's do that this week.
This week?
Oh, this month.
This month.
Let's really do it.
Let's not.
I'd say we did. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews and whatever else takes our fancy. This is episode 64, and I'd like to welcome my co-host Kirsten McDermott, who's laughing already. I thought that was a very mature opening.
It was. That's even though, why it was unexpected.
Even though you were giving me the stink eye throughout it all.
Was I?
Yes, because I insulted you.
Just before.
Yes.
Okay. Hello, how are you?
Good. It's cold. But I know we don't talk about weather.
But it's warm in the house. I turn the heat on just for you. It's 24 degrees.
Your carbon footprint. It's a disgrace.
I'll turn it back down when you're gone because I'm a lizard person and I don't need it.
That's what you were saying before. Pretty sure you said the terms, it's been fucking cold this
winter. It has been, but like outside, not in the house. Like I normally have the heat just at 18 degrees and I have slippers.
18 degrees.
Or 18 during the day and then 20
at night. It switches on at 18. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's...
I have blankets and slippers and carbon footprint, dude. Carbon footprint.
Previously on the Weather Podcast. So as our patrons will know, and others may if they actually listen to the podcast, in September we've got our Patron Choice episode.
Yep.
So the voting was a nomination.
Nominations,
period
yep.
was open. And people nominated.
Yes, they did. We had quite a few responses.
Which was good. And now voting is open on, well, we'll be at the conclusion of this episode.
If you are listening to this episode, voting is open. And if you are a patron who has voting rights and above, you can go to our Patreon page and there will be a new post with a link to a web questionnaire poll, actually. And you just go there and you vote for the one book that you would like us to... discuss, and we will take the books that get the top two votes, and they will be our books for September. And if there's a tie, we might have to flip a coin or something for the tied one. I'm not sure. We'll play that by ear.
No, Ian just chooses. So because not everyone will be able to see the books that are up for nomination.
That's right.
I thought it would be interesting to go through them and spend the next hour discussing them.
Well, let's not do that. Okay. How about you just read the list?
Okay.
So these were the 12 books. We did. I did take a couple out that people had nominated that we had actually read before. So these are the 12 books that our patrons nominated that we have not read.
So the first one is Fish in Exile by Viki Nau, I think is how you pronounce it. I might be wrong. By Light We Knew Our Names by Anne Valenti. Babel's the classic science fiction novel, Babel 17 by Samuel R. Delaney.
Which yes, I've not read and
neither have I.
Happy to.
So we're both naughty for not having read it. That's not, you know, no prejudice. No, that's no favouritism, just noting it. The Sunlight Pilgrims by Jenny Fagan. The Fisherman by John Langan. Beneath by Christy DeMeester. The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry. Leviathan Wakes by James S.A. Corey. Yes, neither of us have read that either. Signal to Noise by Sylvia Marina Garcia. The Stars Are Legion by Cameron Hurley. The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter by Theodora Goss. And last but not least, Karen Memory by Elizabeth Baer.
Yeah, and look, congratulations or thank you rather to our patrons who nominated because I don't think there's a book on that list that I'm looking at going, oh my God, I hope this one doesn't get in. Like, I'm going to be happy to read any of them. So I'm looking forward to seeing what books they're going to be.
I am also
so
sitting on the edge of my seat right now.
No, you're not. You're leaning quite back comfortably. such a liar.
You've got to always give away my secrets.
So, yeah. So, once again, if you are of a patron level that gives you voting rights in the Patron's Choice episode, go to the website. And pretty much, if you go to the website and you see the post, you can vote. That's how it's going to work. So, click on the link and vote for the one book out of those 12 that you would most like us to read. And we will let you know next episode in August what those two books are.
That was really good.
I've been practicing.
I know you have. So, in preparation for the Worldcon, which neither of us are going to.
No, sadly.
Because I hate planes and you are poor.
Yeah. I'm back to being struggling student mode. So, it's actually more a time constraint, really. Jason and I are both in the last 12 to 16 months of our PhD. So, not the best time to take a month-long trip over to Europe.
I have a family.
And we wouldn't just go for Worldcon if we're going to go all the way over there. One of the longest flights in the world you can take from Australia.
Is it really?
Europe, yeah.
It's well, Europe generally, but to Finland in particular?
Oh, I don't. No, I don't think Finland is. But yeah, so it's a super long flight. We're not just going to go there for 5 days of Worldcon. So, we don't have time to take 3 to 4 weeks off to travel around Europe, unfortunately, and I'm sure I'm going to be exceedingly jealous.
And this is the first Finnish convention?
I believe so.
I don't know why I'm asking that question, because you don't necessarily have that answer there.
I can't anticipate every single question you're going to ask and research that beforehand.
Anyway, in preparation for said con, where's it being held? I know Finland, but is it
Helsinki?
Yes, that would make sense. That's the only place I know in that country. So, yes, my ignorance once again is showing. So, in preparation, we have read two books, which was an idea given to us by one of our listeners.
Yeah, one of our listeners, Ben. I'm not sure we mentioned his name last month, but thank you, Ben, for the suggestion. Did email us a couple of months ago and suggest that as the Worldcon is being held in Finland, maybe we should read some Finnish books for... No, just beforehand.
Did he I think I recommended the Emir Taranta, or did he recommend both books?
Oh, to be honest, I can't remember. He gave us a list. He actually gave us a list of like four or five books that which was lovely. Like, thank you, Ben, for also doing our research for us. I think The City of Woven Streets is one you did actually want to read anyway. So you popped that on, and then we chose Marisi, I think, from his list. So
yes, so... Those, you've just given away, but people know that. Anyway,
I think people know.
Yeah, so we're doing City of Woven Streets by Emir Taranta and Marisi by Maria Tuchanov.
Yeah.
So the first book we're discussing is City of Woven Streets, although we should probably point out.
Oh my God, how weird.
That these books are identical.
It was so weird. So I just said how we chose the book. So kind of random, a listener provided us a list. Ian wanted to read another Finnish book that he'd had on his to-be-read pile for a while. And we just picked the other one completely at random from the list. And we have ended up with two books that have so many striking similarities. It's probably actually worth kind of, like, I think this discussion will dovetail the books together. So,
because I think I've forgotten which bit happens in which book. I mean, they...
I read them over about 4 or 5 days back to back. Like, they've not bled together. It's not like they've morphed. But, yeah, there's so many. So, shall we just, before we get into The City of Woven Streets, just talk about the similarities for a second?
Yes.
So people know.
Yes. So, they both feature religious orders.
Well, they're both set on an island.
Oh, shit. The first thing.
They're both on an island.
They're both set on an island.
An island that is relatively isolated from the surrounding world.
Yes. Correct. They're both through a young female protagonist.
Yes. And they're both first-person accounts through a young female protagonist.
Yes. Both who are part of a religious order.
Yep.
Both, okay.
Women only.
Yes, women only religious order. blood is a key theme
So on both islands there is a rare and valuable resource that doesn't involve actual blood, but the thing... the name of the creature that is being harvested is called a blood something. So it's a blood coral in The City of Woven Streets and blood snails in Marisi.
Yes. It's actually, that one link I hadn't made. Yeah, that's right. It's blood coral, isn't it? Because that's what they use for the ink.
Yep.
Oh my God.
And they're both young female protagonist. Yes. So not so when Marisi, the girl Marisi, the titular character, is she is a novice, and in City of Woven Streets is Eliana, who is also like she is a fairly young member and a fairly she's I don't know if they use the word novice, I can't remember, but she's one of the older girls. Like she's not one of the juniors, but she's certainly not like a sister in
yes. And I just thought of another similarity. Like the character that comes into their life, who's in both cases a female.
Yes.
Valeria, I think in...
Yeah, Valeria in the City of Woven Streets and Jay in Marisi.
Both come from the outside.
Yes.
And have had awful...
Yes, have had a traumatic...
Something traumatic happened to them, whether
yeah,
it's...
And
are not that talkative. And well, one for clear reasons, the other one because they're still
she's
going,
a bit traumatised.
Yeah. I just realised.
And also, spoilers for both books, the force that affects the two protagonists that they're kind of fighting against throughout both books, and then at the end it kind of they embrace it and it gives them a power and they fix something. They're both these dark, like literally a nightmare in City Woven Streets, and
the
death aspect of the goddess in Marisi. So that even I just think Finnish people write, that's it. I've read two Finnish books. This is what they are. I don't need to read any more books from Finland. Thank you and good night. I'm totally joking. That was sarcasm. I'm completely joking.
And
but
like
it's
I was
fucking
telling you,
fascinating.
It's a Nordic thing because I'm reading Karen Tidbeck's Amatka.
Yeah, but we read Karen Tidbeck's Jagannath and that's not.
No, but Amatka in particular doesn't have, okay, it's not a religious order. It is a female character. And it is more a science fiction novel than a fantasy novel. But it also has that idea of a community that has strict rules, very strict, almost oppressive rules. Because in less so Marisi, it's probably one of the differences between City of Woven Streets and Marisi. But City of Woven Streets, it's very strict.
Yes.
There's things you can say, things you can't. There's a council. There's a council in Amatka as well.
Yeah, the rules and everything are beyond the House of Weavers where Eliana lives. The whole island is quite an authoritarian regime.
But also I was going to say customs, it's not the right word, but the rituals that they do, this ritualization in all three books. So I'm reading, I don't know what you're reading now, but I'm now reading another book and I've got to say Nordic, not Scandinavian, because Finland is not part of Scandinavia, but Sweden is. But they are all part of the Nordic countries, and so it's a Nordic theme.
I think this kind of...
And water. There's flooding in both books. Lots of fucking flooding.
Well, there's a storm in Marisi.
It still floods.
Yes.
Is there flooding? Yes.
Well, they are an island, so you would assume water would have an impact on
but
both.
They're both coastal. Well, Finland's a coastal country.
Yeah.
So
yes. I just find it quite remarkable that these two books that we didn't choose to go together are just so similar. It's quite bizarre. Like if we actually wanted to sort of compare and contrast two very closely aligned books thematically, structure-wise, character-wise, we couldn't have done better than actually what we've done by
accident.
Without
adding a sad note to this, the only reason I'm able to split them is because I liked one a shitload more than the other.
Me too, actually. Yeah.
Was it the same one, though?
Well, we'll find out.
All right, well, so we're nominally starting with City of Woven Streets,
yes.
But if we start talking about Marisi, suddenly you know why. So, City of Woven Streets, do you want to describe the...
So apart from what we've just said, which applies to both books. Eliana is, as I said, she's a fairly young, is she about like 15, 16-ish, something like that? I can't remember.
That range.
And she's a weaver in the House of Webs. which is one of the houses on the island. And there's also there's a house where the scribes live. There's a house where where the tainted live, and we'll get to the tainted in a minute, the house of the tainted. So there's all these sort of houses that you belong to, and some of them are good to belong to, like the House of Webs and that.
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to stop you there.
Okay.
What the fuck does the House of Webs do?
The House of Webs weaves.
Yeah, why?
Because because it's what they do.
No, that's this is the one. Okay, I'm going to get straight into it. We haven't even gotten to the plot yet.
Yes.
I didn't get that at all at any point. I didn't understand what. Okay, I knew they were weaving a maze, which was sort of a barrier or a protection from outside people because it changes often. And they were using that as in they were weaving, which is cool. This idea they're weaving these walls, these structures out of yarn. And that once they finish them, they would untangle them and weave them again. It's just the ever-changing labyrinth.
Yes, which is a preventative way of, a way of preventing people from entering the House of Webs.
But outside of that, I couldn't understand what their function was within the society.
Well, I think
I think they're a religious order, so I assume that's what they do. They provide religious teaching, except...
No, I don't think they do. No, they don't. So like, a religious order doesn't necessarily provide outreach.
True.
The order can just be of themselves and very insular. And this is, I think, what the House of Webs is. But there is, I don't think we get a very clear raison d'etre for its current state. But we've entered the city and the island at, spoilers, at the end, the whole thing collapses into the sea. We've entered this island in its final days.
Yes.
So, and this is reflected in, the increase in authoritarianism in the city as those in power are struggling to keep power. But it's also reflected in the fact that the House of Webs is no longer doing what it used to do, which was actually weave beautiful tapestries. And that art has been lost. So it's said a couple of times that there are these, I guess, antique tapestries from years and years and years, decades, centuries even perhaps, where the House of Webs did know how to weave these things, and they were taught this by the island's original non-human inhabitants. But they no longer know how to do that, or they've stopped it and then they've forgotten how to do it. And I can't remember if it's made clear why it stopped, whether it was just sort of a natural attrition process or whether they stopped because they had to build the maze for protection, and then they never got back. So they sell some of these ancient tapestries because they're beautiful and elaborate and they can't be made anymore. So they're worth a lot of money. So every year they will sell two or three to fund the ongoing.
It's just the other houses had utility.
Well, and they don't, because so the House of House of Words? Is it just the House of Words?
Yeah, I think so.
Where the scribes are. So what they seem to do is just endlessly copy books that are crumbling and getting old. So they just copy them. And then every year the books which have been copied are burnt in a big ritual fire. So that's all there. So they're not they are maintaining old knowledge, but they're not producing anything new either. I mean, this feels very much like a society in
that's going
in
around
stasis.
In circles, in absent
stasis. It's got nothing
I suppose
else to do.
Here we go. In Maresi, the island, the religious order on the island has a clear utility.
Yeah, they do.
Both in taking young girls in, but also in harvesting these snails that they then sell on the dye.
Well, they
and other things that they.
Well, in Maresi, the order the purpose of the order is. They take in young girls, but they also send them back out. Like, the snails is what they do to fund their existence.
Yes.
There's no divine, mandate to harvest the blood snails or anything like that. But their sort of purpose is to educate the world. So they take girls in, many of whom are, not all of whom, because they do take in girls from good families and who want to just learn things. But they take in a lot of girls who are fleeing persecution and worse. But one of their stated goals is a lot of their novices who eventually, and Maresi herself by the end, who do learn things and are trained in various skills and arts and crafts and knowledge and so on, they will go back out into the world, back to the communities they came from and take that knowledge and take the science
and take the learning. So there's a clear through line. There isn't with City of Woe. It just bugged me.
Well, like
and I
said,
understand that it's in status, but there's no sense that.
But it's at the end, like even with the blood coral. Okay, so let's talk about the House of the Tainted.
Okay.
Because that's where people who at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, now, just so we know, we've gone back to City of Woven Streets.
Oh, yes, sorry. This is City of Woven Streets. Or it's also called, for our US listeners, I believe it's called The Weaver in the US. So it's the same book. So on the island, there's a what's called a dream plague. And they're basically night terrors. So it's people have really, really bad, not just nightmares, but night terrors. And those people are called the Tainted. And because it's considered a plague or a sickness that can be
It's more
spread,
than just a night terror. Their eyes go black.
Yes, there's this fantastical
element to it. It isn't just they're having the sweats or paralysis.
No, but it's not just a dream or a bad dream. Like it's considered quite a plague. So anyone who manifests symptoms of this, they're tainted and they go into the House of the Tainted, which isn't a house so much as a forced labor prison. and they get branded with a tattoo on their forehead so everybody knows they're tainted. They no longer have any place in society. But what the society is doing is using the people who are in the House of the Tainted to harvest this blood coral, which is really valuable. And they export it, but they also use it for their own ceremonial purposes.
But also the coral itself is seen as a way of protecting against the dreams.
Yes.
That's why they all get tattooed every year with that ink.
Well, that's
why they're meant to. Well, that's what's meant to be happening.
Yeah. So that's what the tainted are being used as essentially imprisoned labor and forced to go out and dive for the blood coral, which in line with everything else that's happening on the island is becoming increasingly rare and increasingly difficult and dangerous to harvest. So like this whole community, this whole society is coming to an end and we're witnessing the death throes and then eventually the actual death. So it's, I get what you're saying, like there was kind of no point, but it feels to me like that's the point. The point is that there is no longer a point to this society. This is a colonizing society who has stripped the resources of the island, all but completely massacred its original inhabitants, and is desperately trying to stay alive, despite the fact that there's no more resources, there's no more point for it to even exist. It's having to oppress and enslave its own citizens to keep going. So,
which sounds awfully depressing, which frankly is,
it is
pretty depressing. I suppose my issue with the City of Woven Streets was that I struggled. So I really loved her first novel, The Memory of Water.
I've not read that. I want to now, though, because the writing itself I quite
like. Oh, the writing in the...
We should say also that Emmy Iturranta provided her own English translation.
Yeah, well, she did with Memory of Water as well. So Memory of Water
book.
Is her...
So these are her the author's words in English. She wrote the book first in Finnish, but she did her own translation of this book.
Yes. Memory which of Water is like, glorious. Beautifully written, really compelling. I won't go too much into it because it's not a review for that book, but really engaging piece of writing. It has a rhythm to it, which I clicked with straight away.
Yep.
This book, I didn't click. I never got into the rhythm. And when I did get into the rhythm at times, things would happen that would just kill the momentum. One of those being when Eliana is sent to the House of the Tainted.
Yeah.
I felt just as the book was beginning to start to move forward, you know, they were planning ways of somehow getting off the island and dealing with the council and that. She's shunted off to the House of the Tainted to essentially harvest this blood coral. And I get why that happens, but it just is it just killed any sort of progression, any sort of, it just murdered the book in one foul swoop. And only because we know that that's not going to be where she stays. She's going to get out. And it does another thing that really irritates me later on, where so Valeria is her, this person from the outside.
And we should just make a mention of Valeria. Valeria is found almost dead on the beach and her tongue has been severed and she's been assaulted and she gets taken in by the House of Webs. And for a couple of chapters, her identity isn't known you know, she's a mystery. And then later her identity becomes clear.
And she has an invisible ink tattoo of Eliana's name.
That's right.
And they become lovers. And then they get split apart because Eliana gets sent to the House of the Tainted. And all that is she's desperate to get out to find Valeria.
Yeah.
She gets out and told Valeria's dead.
Yeah.
Three pages later,
Valeria is alive.
Valeria is alive again. I thought, well, what was the point of that?
It was a very...
there were these little clunky bits.
It was a very truncated little rise and fall.
Correct. There were these clunky bits throughout the book. That's just an example, which just murdered the momentum for me. And given that I wasn't that sold on the world building to begin with, I mean, I finished it, but I found it hard to connect with this book at any real point.
There were, I mean... You're right. Like I connected and deconnected several times, if that makes sense. So, and it's, I think it's what you said, just as you're kind of getting into a part of the book, it really abruptly shifts gears and takes you somewhere else. And then it takes a little while to get into that part of the book.
Which is sometimes really exciting.
But this was, this, I don't know. And for some reason this wasn't. So I didn't really, I mean, I like the House of the Tainted part, like in and of itself. And the House of Webs was interesting, and that was kind of going somewhere, and then it got cut off. And it kind of got, like, the pivot was the two officers who come to Lieutenant Biros and Lieutenant Lozano.
I think you've nearly got that right, and I'm not even looking. I mean, I didn't remember their names.
Pretty much played in the book as almost like a Shakespearean comic relief. In terms of not just their dialogue and what they say, but also how the text represents them. Like it's difficult to explain, but they're always referred to as their full names, like Lieutenant Biros and Lieutenant Lozano, and there's this like back and forth sort of repartee between them almost. And so we first see them when they come to question Eliana about
they're a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern type.
Yes, that's what they feel like. Exactly. Yeah. And we meet them first when they come to question Eliana about the girl who's been found with her tongue missing, because Eliana's name's on her palm. So there's suspicions that she's somehow involved. And then we meet them again when they come to say, oh no, now we know who she is and she was a missing girl and blah, blah, blah. And then I think only the third time, or maybe there's another time they come in, but they're basically the pivot which hinges the book between the House of Webs and the House of the Tainted. Because when Valeria is taken away from the House of Webs, she's arrested because she's carrying something that she shouldn't be. Not that she knows what it is, but she's arrested under suspicion of being involved in the Dreamer Rebellion, because there is a resistance against the council because of the House of the Tainted and arresting people who have nightmares and all that sort of stuff. And she's suspected as being a part of it because the thing she has is a symbol of that. But she didn't know. And Eliana, who gave it to her, didn't know. And it's just a thing. So Eliana goes after her through a secret tunnel in the House of Webs to find her. And at the end of that tunnel, Lieutenant Biros and Lieutenant Lozano were there waiting for her. And I actually thought, like, I think I even, like, chuckled aloud when they appeared, because I went, oh, that's really clever. They're actually good guys. Because she got sent there by the Weaver, who's the head of the House of Webs. And then she bumps into these two guys. And honestly, for half a page, I thought, oh, it's going to turn out that they're actually in the Resistance. That's really clever. And they're just these bumbling kind of slightly sinister but in a comedic way. And actually, they're going to be...
Yep.
And no, they were actually there to arrest her and take her to the House of the Tainted. And that was like really like...
And then it's compounded by the fact...
It was quite disappointing.
It's compounded by the fact that we find out that they're actually the ones who mutilated...
That's right.
...and tried to kill Valeria.
Which is what you suspect at the beginning when they come in.
That's the case.
Yeah, you come in asking questions and trying to set her up, and then later they come in and say, oh no, we...
There's two attackers. And they have vociferously denied that there was two involved.
Yes, and they've arrested some stool pigeon to do it. And so you immediately suspect that they were involved. Yeah. And that's why I thought when she ran into them in the tunnel that it was, and it was like, oh, we're going to find out actually they're the good guys. But no, they're just the bad guys we always thought they were, and they take her away, and then we're in the House of the Tainted. And it was a really disappointing pivot.
I think part of the problem for me is that there is this, I was going to say spludge.
Spludge. Please elucidate on spludge.
There's this chunk of exposition at the very end, but it feels like a spludge exposition. Where the spinner, now the spinner is I suppose, a arachnid type creature who we get to see earlier on, who clearly is important to the way this society once worked, not does work now.
Well, the spinner is one of the original inhabitants of the island who are not human, and they're an arachnid type creature, and they were almost wiped out by...
No, well, that's well said, except that everything you've just said there is what we're told in this splooge bit.
Yes, yes.
So up until the last 20 pages, you could have sort of passed the spinner off as, a hallucination. Not really. I mean, it's clearly a real creature.
Yeah.
But it feels like it's part of a different book in a sense, even though I know it creates webs and webs, yarn, weaving. I get all that. But it doesn't fit in the book. Then suddenly the spinner decides this is the time. Probably because Eliana, is her nightmare powers are beginning to instantiate, decides this is the time to explain everything that's going on.
Yes.
In a really awkward, clunky piece of exposition, which is actually really interesting, but it's too late in the novel for me to give a shit at this point.
Yeah, it's really late. It's in the last two chapters or something.
Yeah, it's basically
so late.
You know, you humans, you came to the island and you didn't wipe us out originally. In fact, what happened is that we linked, and the nightmares are in fact part of an ability to manipulate reality in some way.
And we helped you, and we taught you how to weave.
But then greedy people and jealous people got annoyed because only some of you had that ability, not all of you, and decided to kill us, kill my family, kill all the other spinners. And so that's it. And create this shitty society you now live in.
And now I'm fed up with it, so I'm going to destroy it.
Yeah, basically.
She's going to let it be destroyed.
Correct, because it was already on the verge of destruction.
Yes, that's right. And she says she could stop it, but she's not going to, because why would you genocide, colonialism, invasion, exploitation? Why would you save this world?
Correct. And you think, that'd be a lot more interesting if that had been halfway through the book.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Maybe not,
with you.
Maybe or seeded in a better way than just.
Yeah, it's quite a heavy sort of intro for something that isn't. It was, I think, it relates to what you were saying. It's not something I was ever wondering about, because the spinner's there, but she does feel like she might either be part of Eliana's nightmare kind of hallucinations that she sort of has, and there's those italicized bits of text that are interspersed some of the chapters that we're not sure what they are. They might be from, I think now they're the spinner's communications with Eliana through her dreams, but you don't know what they are. And like, I was happy with the spinner being there. She didn't feel to me like she didn't belong, but I wasn't throughout the book wondering like, who is she? Where does she come from? Is she part of, she was just like the sort of the mystery at the center of the House of Webs, but not like a mystery as in like a religious mystery, not as in a mystery I needed to solve as the reader, but just she was obviously a generative force behind the House of Webs. And it's like, oh, okay, so they've got this sort of spider monster alien angel thing that powers the house. And it's not like throughout the book I was wondering about this story and then it gets revealed. Like, the book does not provide hints that would make you wonder about things like this, and then you get the story and you go, oh, I see. So it does. It comes out of nowhere. It answers a whole bunch of questions you were never even thinking about. And it should have either been seeded a bit better, so you got more hints about this past civilization.
Just go back a sec. I don't think it answers questions that we weren't thinking about. We do wonder what the nightmares are about, and it answers that bit.
Yeah.
I suppose my disappointment was that the book just got interesting at this point.
Right.
To me, that's actually quite what the spinner says is really interesting. I just wish we'd been told this, or it had become more clearer earlier than now. And then we have 10 pages left of the book, more or less, and everything not gets resolved, but the baddies lose. And it's so abrupt and quickly tied up.
For me, so here's my, the disappointment I had was the fact that the book, like everything you said, but this is why. So throughout the book, you've got this resistance movement that we get told. It's this really authoritarian society. Yeah. We've had the romance between Eliana and Valeria, and that was beautifully done and deftly done. They get severed as soon as they're kind of just starting to get together, and all of this runs through, and you've got all these other people. You've got Valeria's aunt, who's a part of the resistance.
Yes.
You've got, we find out about Valeria's father and mother, who were investigating the properties of the tattoo ink and what they might actually be used for, which was a bit more nefarious than what...
I never really got that.
Yeah, he wrote a graphic novel.
I got that bit, that there's a codex.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. I didn't get what the brother, how the brother... new to find it.
That was a really convenient little, they're throwing out the codex. Like, so there's, so Valeria's father wrote this illustrated book about his story and his discovery about the tattoo ink, and also at the end expresses his fears that he's going to get killed, which Valeria's parents are dead at the beginning of the novel. They've been killed in a air gondolier accident. And we find out the council did that because he was getting too close to the truth, sort of thing.
Which is what, though? What truth?
That so the tattoo ink is suppressing the dreams and therefore causing mental illness and night, because it's not healthy not to dream. It is not healthy to not dream.
Oh, okay. So I didn't make that connection.
Yeah.
I just...
So that's kind of the thing. So he's wanting to let people know that this is what
they're
doing.
No, I thought it was known that the tattooing was a way of protecting against nightmares. I suppose the thing that he's found out is that, yeah, but to do that, it's stopping you from dreaming.
Yeah.
Dreaming is terror. Not doing that is bad. And that's what's causing...
And that's... Yes, okay, right?
Gotcha.
So,
right. Thank you.
And so someone has found this explanatory book and gone, oh, no, this must be destroyed. And instead of just destroying it, as you would do, surely, they throw it onto the pile of... copied codexes that are due to be burnt in this annual House of Words bonfire. And Janos, Eliana's brother, who works at the House of, who is a scribe at the House of Words, happens to find it and go, this looks interesting. I might show it to my sister because her name's in it. It's like, it's such a unwieldy coincidence and it doesn't make sense. Like if you're you know, part of the council or an advisor to the council, someone who's in the upper echelons,
yep,
and you find this book, this seditious book, and you don't want anyone else to see it and you want to destroy it, why don't you just destroy it? Rip it up, soak it in water, burn it yourself is the only time fire used is when this annual bonfire is held. I mean, it makes no sense. And then that Janos would coincidentally find it among all these hundreds of other tomes that are being due to be burnt. And Eliana's name is on the cover. And that relates to the tattoo that's on Valeria's hand. So that's why it perks his interest. It's like, oh, here's a book with my sister's name on the cover. That's weird. But it's like, it's such a
By the way, the Eliana thing is a code. Again, wasn't entirely clear to me. It's not actually referring to Eliana.
No, it's not. She just happens to have that name, which again is quite a coincidence.
It's a bizarre,
And it is a coincidence. It's not just that, oh, well, this is the character the story's about, that's why.
Yeah.
It is a coincidence.
It's a genuine...
Because she don't, like, and so what I was saying, and what I was saying is this is why the book was, like, at its core, very disappointing to me, because there's this great section after she escapes from the House of the Tainted, because the House of the Tainted gets flooded by a huge storm, so there's chaos and she gets to escape with the help from a guard, and she ends up back, she meets her brother Janos, they end up being back at the, I guess one of the not the headquarters, but one of the safe houses that the resistance is using, and they get to meet other people in the resistance,
yep,
and they learn that they've got all these plans, and they've got, you know, they've got actual plans to do stuff.
To destroy the Death Star.
And there's this wonderful, just to destroy the Death Star, exactly. And there's this wonderful line, and I'll just read this out. So this is from the City of Woven Streets. Valeria, Janos and I may have come across the Codex, but we are pebbles on a wide and far-stretching shore, not the moon that will turn the tide. Without us and the Codex, dreamers would have found another way to proceed. They may have been dreaming of a new future for the island when we were not even babies in our cots yet, and they have known me for less than a day. There is no reason why they should trust me with their most important plans. And that's because they're talking stuff and they don't want her around. And that was great. Like, I read that. That's fantastic. This is a book which shows people on the periphery of a much bigger movement, a much more capable movement, and it shows a character who's going, oh, okay, I've done my part, I can step back. And it was really refreshing. And then, of course, she does end up being the chosen one.
Yeah.
Because she can harness this nightmare power, and the spinner tells her it's a really rare gift and not many people can do it, but you can do it and that's why I've chosen you. So it undermined what I really appreciated, this what seemed to me at the time, and this is like 82% of the way into the book, so it's fairly near the end, and it seemed then to cast the book in this light of being like, here is a cog in the wheel. Here are some people who contributed to the resistance, but they're not, you know, these are people on the periphery, and that's a really interesting story. And then it turns out to be, oh no, actually she is the chosen one. She's the one who has the special power and will save the world, which she does. And it's
she saves the people off the island.
That's right. She doesn't save the island. It does disintegrate into the sea. But she does give people a chance to leave, whereas the spinner was just going to let it all happen and no one would know and everyone would drown. And the only one who would get to leave would be Ileana and whoever who was immediately around.
Ileana essentially holds the tectonic plates together in a sense.
She does.
It's not really clear what she's doing, but she's doing something like that.
Well, there's like
it comes back to threads.
Threads that hold the world together, or hold reality together, and she's managing to kind of hold them together herself in time to warn people to leave, and a lot of people get off the island. But that's it. It flipped from being this story that you were going all along because of the nature of the story. It is a fantasy. It is this young girl. She is finding stuff out. She is being persecuted, specifically herself. Like, her name is on this girl's hand. Like, it goes from being the story where you expect her to be a chosen one, and then 80% of the way through, there's a paragraph that I just read and it flipped that. And I went, that's great. That subverted the expectation of a very common trope of the form and said, hey, it's not about chosen people. It's about movements. It's about a whole bunch of people helping and everybody's necessary, but no one is super important, like above everyone else. And that was really great. And then it subverted that. I went back to being a chosen one story. So I was really ultimately quite disappointed by that dynamic.
No, I agree.
There was some beautiful stuff in it. I love the singing Medusas, which are these jellyfish type things that take pain away.
Yeah.
I loved, like I said, the language of the book was beautiful. A little bit overwrought sometimes, but mostly beautiful.
I didn't get there was some investigation into the Medusas and how they were dying and how that's some...
Yeah, they were washed up on the beach.
Yeah, so. But one Medusa's skin was different to another, and this was a symbol, I don't know, that the council were...
Oh, yeah,
were,
that's right.
It's never sort of went anywhere.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that was. I
don't normally would normally say this, but there was actually potential for a second book here and not for it all to just sort of
end. I was so glad it was a one book thing.
No, to be fair, yes, I agree with you.
Yeah.
But if it was going to end the way it did, it needed to be structured differently.
I do. I think so. I think that it was very, as you say, exposition heavy, and that should have been seeded throughout. And perhaps that the history of the island, even if that's been suppressed and is considered a forbidden history.
Why is the spinner allowed to live? That's the other thing.
I don't think they knew the spinner, like the authorities. That's why I think the spinner is a remnant. She's hiding in the House of Webs. I don't think the council knows the spinner's there.
Yeah,
she's a remnant.
The weaver does.
The weaver does. Yeah, but I mean, the weaver's not part of the council. The
no,
weaver's
I know.
Not. And she is being
blackmailed because
of her child, her adult child, who's the guard in the House of the Tainted,
who's hermaphrodite.
Intersex, I would
intersex,
say.
Intersex, okay,
We don't.
Which
know.
Was actually, that's again, was an interesting element thrown in the last 15 seconds of the book.
Yeah, but it wasn't thrown in. We see the guard for several chapters because Ileana's in the House of the Tainted for a long time. There's actually things said about the guard that do make you wonder about her gender. She's assumed to be a her, and then at the end, the weaver calls her a son.
Yeah.
And we're told that. So when the baby was born, the gender of the baby wasn't clear, and we're told that children like that on the island are normally killed, and the weaver managed to get her child away and raise them, and so it's indeterminate gender.
Okay.
This is the guard, and that's why the weaver sort of threw Ileana to Lieutenants Biros and Lozano, because she was being blackmailed that her child would be killed. But yes, it's like...
It just felt
I didn't
ham-fisted.
Mind. Look, I didn't mind all of this stuff being put in there because it built the world. It did build the world.
Happens in the last 50 pages.
There's so much that happens in the last 50 pages. There is so much. And
whereas, let's move to it because I feel like I've said all
okay.
I want to say.
Marisi
is both shorter by half, it's literally half the length, and is as a result is a lot simpler, but
really tight,
but elegant.
It's a really tightly written narrative.
Elegant.
Yeah.
And sophisticated in its own way piece of writing.
Yeah. Which I've really enjoyed reading Maurice.
I loved Maurice.
For the most part.
Oh, no, I loved it to the point where I went and looked for the second book, which is out now, Neon Del, I think it is.
Which is the name of the ship that brought the original sisters to the island who founded the abbey. So is it a prequel? Have you?
It may be a prequel.
Oh,
I don't
you
know.
Haven't I've started reading
no,
it.
No, I
right.
haven't. So, no, I haven't started
I'm assuming
reading.
It must be a prequel because if it's named after the ship. But no, I don't know. Maybe one of the girls gets named that.
Because I needed a a Nordic break, and then therefore I read Karen Tidbeck. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. Yeah. Either.
Anyway, I was going to say Scandinavian, but Finland's not in Scandinavia. Okay. So, you've already hinted that you had a problem with it.
Minor problems. I did really like this book. It was had more endings than Lord of the Rings. I could have done without all of the endings.
Does. Yeah, these little three or four.
Oh my goodness! It's like had about four epilogues. It was ridiculous.
It's 3 years later, and I thought I'd write another note. Hi, everyone.
So we should say for those who haven't read it, this book is presented as a journal.
Yes.
Being not a journal that progresses at the time the story is being told. It's being written as a book
after
that Maurice, a year later, after the events of the main part of the story that we're told has happened, she has been asked to record her memory of the events so that that can be put into the library of knowledge that the sisters have, because it was an important thing that happened on the island, so they want a record of it. So 95% of the book is that. It's Maurice saying, hi, I'm Maurice. I'm going to tell you this story about this thing that happened.
I'm a pretty shit storyteller, but I'll do my best.
She's a pretty good storyteller, actually.
That's what I was thinking. No, you're not. You know. Put yourself down.
So she's, so that's the majority of the book. And then it kind of ends with her saying, so that's what happened. And then like the next chapter is like, oh, it's been 3 years later and I thought I'd come back and add this little bit. But even that has like, it doesn't like there's three sort of parts. You go, oh, there's more. it's like it really, it was kind of nice to see, like what happened after, like that was nice. I just think it was a bit clumsily done in the way it was tacked on. It's not my book.
There's
so
such small sections.
They are. And you could have just had one section. It might have even been.
It's not Frodo going back to the thingamabob and you have a whole new battle scene with.
No. It's not.
It's.
But yeah, because they were so small and truncated and tacked on, it felt like it wasn't. It were these little stop start endings. And I'm not saying this is the case, but it felt as though the writer just couldn't end it. So he wrote another ending and then another ending and then another ending, which I'm sure is not the case. But yeah, I thought about it and thought actually it would have been really cool if that was Maurice's story and then there may have been a coda at the end.
But it was
but maybe from
else.
Another character who came and said, I just thought I'd update you about what happened with Maurice.
Yeah,
she's left the island and this is why and blah, blah, blah. Because it just, like having had her story, which as we say was really tight and elegantly written, that's a great word to describe it. And then it had just these clumsy little epilogues at the end, which sort of, it didn't undermine the story in any way, but it just didn't, as a reader, it didn't leave me with a very satisfying sense of an ending. I think it's probably the best way I can describe it.
Or you could just rip those pages out of your book and then you get your...
I've got a Kindle, so I can't. And I wouldn't, like, as I said, it was nice to know what happened next. I just think the way it was presented was clunky.
I suppose, if someone else had written the code. Yeah.
Or if there'd just been one thing. Like Maurice coming back once. So, I just want to let you know I'm leaving the island. And here's why. You know, I don't know. Because we have to remember, like, as I said, this is not a journal that's being written as the story progresses. She's already writing it from a point a year in the future. So it's not as though it just ends and it's like, oh, what happens next? Like, you know, we already get the sense of a story that has happened, that is being told in retrospect and with all of the problems that may bring. Yeah, the ending I did not.
I didn't have a problem with it, so let's move on.
Okay.
And let's disregard everything you've just said for the last 10 minutes. It didn't bother me as such because they are so small. But I did think it was odd. I know, I agree with you there.
Yeah.
I thought, wait, there's more? What? Oh, whatever. Having said that, so it's a children's book.
Well, here's what's really weird. Because I did a lot of, not a lot, last night actually for a couple of hours. I did some, as is my wont, some looking at reviews and commentary after I'd read the book. And everybody's talking about this as YA. I'm not a huge expert on the genre, but it felt pitched too young for YA.
No, it won an award for a children's book.
Right. Okay. Because I read there were so many.
We've got nominated.
There were so many people talking about it as a YA book. I think the Publishers Weekly review said it was YA. There's a whole bunch of YA book bloggers. And
our protagonist is a young adult.
Well, here's the thing. So she's.
But she's very innocent.
So at the time the story happened, I think she's about 13, because Jay arrives to the island and she estimates Jay's age as being 14 or 15, which she says is a year or two older than her. So she's about 13,
okay.
Which means at the time she's writing the bulk of this book, she's about 14. And as I said, I'm not an expert in the YA genre, but one of the things that I've been told and have read several times is that in YA, the age of the characters is usually the same, but more often a year or two older than the targeted reading age, because kids and teenagers don't like to read about people younger than them, is the simplistic answer. I don't know how true that is, but in terms of the genre, I believe that theory holds. So if you have a book about 13, 14-year-olds written by a 14-year-old at the time, about a time when she was 13, yeah, this becomes a not a YA book, but a, what do they call them, the tweens now? I hate that word. like the American publishing industry calls a middle grade book, I think, which is the sort of the age of 8 to 12 type, which would fit with what I do know about how genre determines age and vice versa. But I might be wrong about all of that, and there may have been a recent shift, but it is really interesting that it does appear to be that the age of the readers this book is aimed at is like your sort of 10 to 12 year olds.
So,
I would guess.
Published by Pushkin Press, who do a lot of translated work, and this is their children's arm.
Yeah, and it reminded me of A Single Stone, the book that we read a couple of years ago.
Very much so, yeah.
Again, pitched to that group, which it's not yet into YA, it's still that slightly younger group of readers who are going to be teenagers in a year or two but aren't yet. So that was it was just when I was reading it, I assumed that was what the target sort of readership age was. And it was just interesting to read a whole bunch of reviews afterwards talking about this as a YA book. And it's like, is it? Wow. Okay. That said, I'm a 40. What? 40. How old am I this year? What's the year? 18.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, in my 40s, I really enjoyed it. So, yeah. As with all...
If it was a YA book, I think it would have been more violent, funnily enough.
I think it would have been.
Because it holds back on... There are some bad things that happen towards the end.
There's nothing that happens on screen.
Nothing happens on screen.
Even the things
that
have happened.
And no one actually dies.
And we'll get to that, because that's my other quibble with the book. But we'll get to that. So, Ian, what's this book about? Apart from all of the island stuff we mentioned at the beginning. Is there anything else we should mention? Probably not.
Well, no, probably not. We've said it all.
It's Marisi.
It's an island which it's the location of the Red Abbey. It's called the Red Abbey because blood plays a major role.
Well, the blood snails.
Well, that's one of the reasons. It's not the only reason, though. I think that point's made.
Yes, you're right.
One reason why it's called the Red Abbey, but actually blood is a critical part of the religious order as part of the triple... headed goddess or whatever. Yeah. How do you say it? The maid, the crone?
The maiden mother crone.
Yes.
Yep.
And you're right, she is 13-year-old because the cover copy says she's 13.
Oh, well, there you go.
There you go. Well done. Good maths. So, yes, and it's about her. It's about Marisi. It's her story. She's 13. She's very innocent.
Yeah. She's an older novice. So there are several
age groups.
They're
a junior and older. She hasn't been chosen by a sister yet to follow a certain like in City of Woven Streets, there are houses that have specific things. Here, it's each sister has so there's one for knowledge, one who harvests the snail, one who is more about fertility and sexuality.
Well, there are like three of the sisters are not manifestations of, but they are closely aligned to, and I guess representations of a facet of the goddess on
there's the mother
on the
herself.
Island. So mother and the rose, who is the maiden, and sister O, who is the crone.
Yes,
that we find out she's the crone a bit later, and she is the keeper of knowledge.
Yes,
which I liked. That was a nice touch.
So that's it, really. I mean, that's it. And this is the story of what happens when Jay comes to the island, an outsider who's traumatized, and how she
and she's fled from a really horrible misogynistic culture,
like, really bad.
And she's been like. Spirited away by her mother, you know, who is probably
sort of,
dead.
You'd sort of say unrealistic.
Oh yeah,
but
no, I wouldn't.
Not that. You just read shit and you go, yeah, fuck, that's.
It's really funny further. Because one of the reviews I quickly read was a very short review from a teenage or a young adult blogger, and when I say like she was a young person, as well as writing about YA books, and she was she said something about. Oh, she was really interested in this like twisted world and how it came about and like who was it's like, dude, this is the world. It's like it may not be the world where you live.
Because Jay's sister is gives water to a boy back in their land.
Who asks for water.
Yes.
And she gives him some water.
This is interpreted because he's from another culture within the country.
Another sect. Or cultural grouping.
She is immediately labelled as a whore, and this is a bad mark on the family. Therefore, father and sons have to bury her alive.
As an honour killing.
Correct.
Yes.
This, of course, horrifies Jay and her mother gets Jay out of town, essentially.
Yeah, because...
And it's not easy, because there are people who are friends with the father, who are frightened that the father will seek revenge, so they don't help Jay. It's not a simple journey.
No, it's not.
To the Red Abbey. It's pretty... The journey itself is harrowing. Like a good chunk of her backstory anyway.
But all of that we get in backstory from Jay over the course of the book because, she's very quiet when she arrives and doesn't want to talk about anything, and then gradually she befriends Maurice, or Maurice befriends her.
Yes.
And she gradually reveals bits of her history.
And she keeps saying, she keeps warning that her father will come.
Yeah.
And no one takes any real attention because they're not arrogant or apathetic about their own safety. I mean, but the abbey has it's up on a massive hill. There's walls, there's protections, and they are one of the few sources of this red snail, blood snail.
Probably the only one.
And it's of such high value that people probably don't want to fuck with them too much. So, yeah, they're not ignorant of danger, but they're not. They feel safe. They feel secure.
Yeah,
it's a secure place. So when Jay's dad does come a knocking.
Well, with his pirate ship.
With his pirate ship. Yeah, it's bad. But, no, I loved it. I just, Maurice's voice is just, there is an innocence.
The voice of this book is fantastic. And I should say, this is beautifully translated. The author, Maria Chaninoff, didn't translate it. It was an in-house translator, I assume, or arranged by Pushkin. The name was not mentioned in the copyright matter of the book, which is really sad. Like, I think translators should get an acknowledgement in the book. They've got no copyright over the book, but I think they should be acknowledged. They play a really important role because this would not have been such a good book to read if it was a bad translation. It's a beautiful translation.
Yeah, so we're sorry that we're not noting the translator. Cause
yeah, if anyone does know, please like tweet us and let us know.
But look, the one thing I'm a guy. I don't know if you know this.
Oh, I had noticed.
Yeah. So I do like, so this is clearly, I think, a strong feminist novel.
Oh, yes.
Given its take on the world. And I did read a few reviews, and I read the review by Britt Mandello, I think it is. Yep, Britt Mandello on tour.com. And one of her critiques...
Oh, I bet she talked about gender essentialism.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is something that doesn't occur to me.
Yeah.
Okay, for a variety of reasons. But it is a key... The magic and the way things work does require female, it's female empowerment.
Female energy.
Female energy. Yep. So I suppose the question is, if a transgender person came to this island, what would be the case? It's not like this question's asked in the book. It's not even broached. It's not Yeah, it's not.
No, this is like, so the book's definitely a feminist book, and it's really important from that perspective, especially as it's targeted at such, like, at a young readership. It is a simplistic feminism.
Well, because it puts onus on biology.
Yes.
Well, it doesn't actively do it. It's just by the nature of the world building.
It's by the nature of the world building.
Biology clearly is a key to this.
Yes, menstruation is important.
Yes.
Well, that's what I said. Women's hair is important. And look, it's like second wave feminism type feminism. It's not as, I guess, nuanced. And I don't know how much of that you can ascribe to the fact that it is written for children. So I don't know what reluctance there might be to bring more intersectional feminism into these types of books. I don't think you can't.
So here's the question.
I think you can and you should. It was interesting that we did have an intersex character in The City of Woven Streets.
Yes. So, yes, correct.
But we have cis men and cis women in this book, and there's never any question that that's just how the world is.
Yes.
There are men, there are women. And for the most part, men are bad.
Well, more than that. It's more than that. In City of Woven Streets, to its credit, it has a lesbian...
yes, there's queer. There's a queer relationship.
It's intersex. It actually covers all that.
In
the magic in that book isn't biologically based. It's
no,
just
it's
people.
Not.
Some people can do it. Some people can't. It doesn't matter what their gender is.
Yeah.
Clearly, because there's men who are getting...
Yeah.
You know, there's a man's cell and there's a women's cell in the House of the Tainted.
Absolutely.
So this is very much about biology. This is all about blood and the blood of... and menstrual blood, etc. That is what it is. So if you turn up to this island and you identify as a woman, but you don't have the equipment to do what these women can do, what does that mean?
I assume it
means that the magic doesn't work.
I don't know. There's this...
I suppose if you ask Maria, I can't pronounce her second name properly. So
Tchananov.
I'd say that... Look, I don't know what she would say. I'm
gonna find her. Let's not put words into
No, fair enough.
Mouth.
But I do think about the author in this instance, where they would say, well, that... does this mean every book has to be
intersectional?
Does every single book have to be intersectional?
No, it doesn't. And I think, and look, there's this.
You've got your slumpy look on your.
No, I'm just saying there is this definite section of people who identify themselves as progressive. There's, I think, a definite section that the left has a problem with imperfection, ideologically, that quite frankly, the right doesn't have such a problem with. And I think it's to our detriment. I think we, and I haven't read the Brit Mandela review, so I don't know what she says.
It's a very good review because she's quite positive about the book.
Oh,
but
good.
This is a point. This is not an attack on the novel.
Yeah.
It says, and she does bring up second wave feminism, and it's a sort of that Ursula K. Le Guin type of view of the world. It's a very 70s take.
Yeah.
But she says all that.
Yeah.
And she's very positive of the book, though, but she says it's something that she can't escape from.
No, that's true. And I think there's a difference when pointing something out like that and throwing babies away with bathwater. And I think the left sometimes, or some people on the left have a propensity to throw out the babies with the bathwater and say, well, if it's not perfect, it's rubbish. I'm not saying everybody on the left does this, and most people don't, but there is, you know, you do see... frequently, very harsh criticism based on an aspect of something that kind of gets rid of the whole thing. And I think that's true. You would not throw Marisi out because it's feminism aimed at children is a little simplistic, which it is. It is simplistic. It's also there's a simplicity about the fact that you have all of these young and teenage girls at this abbey, and there's almost no friction. Like none. And
there's a little bit. There's one character who's a bit hoity-toity than the others.
There's one sister who Marisi says thinks she's kind of the best because she's
Oh, and there's
the
a novice
one.
As well.
And her novice.
No, not her novice. Another novice. No, it's not her novice.
Oh,
her
okay.
novice is actually that hoity-toity sister. I don't know why I'm using the word hoity-toity. has a novice who Marisi's friends with, and she's surprised rich novice wasn't connected to that. Yeah. So there is a bit of that.
There's there's no real friction. There's no real, and which kind of leads you to believe that, like, I guess in the world of the book, that leads you down the path of thinking, well, if you take men out of the equation, women will get along just fine. And in some respects, a lot of the depicted friction among girls and women, especially in fictional narratives, is centered around competition or jealousy over a male or a male surrogate. So if you take them out of the equation, that friction goes. But that doesn't mean there's not going to be friction and some power struggles
and again,
a whole bunch of stuff. Because we're primates and we have a society and
House
we have
of Webs,
frictions.
The House of Webs does have friction.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
See, that's where a slightly more adult book hits it on the nail.
Yeah.
Does a better job of it.
And I think you could
even
have...
This is a much better book as a reading experience.
You could have had some of that friction... Which would have been, it would have been wonderful because it would have removed that kind of friction being centered around a male character.
Yep.
But it still shows that, you know, everything is not like, you know, utopian bliss just because you take men out of the equation. And what I found really, really interesting is because there's a mention, so we've been saying how men aren't allowed on the island. That's not actually true. The only settlement on the island is the Abbey. That's the only settlement. It's not like there's another village. It's not like the Abbey is in the middle of a city. The Abbey is the only thing on the island. And the Abbey, as many religious orders are, is a single gender order.
Yep.
It's for women, girls and women. So, of course, there will not be any men living in the Abbey and joining the order. And they do all their own work. They do everything. They do everything from growing and harvesting vegetables to fixing the roof to farming animals to, like, they do the lot. So they don't even need anyone to come along and work for them. They do everything.
Yes.
And there's this intriguing little line where Marisi relates something that's told to her where there was at least one time when a man did come to the Abbey because he was ill or injured, I can't remember.
Yes.
And the sisters treated him and looked after him until he was better.
Yep.
So it's not as though men are forbidden.
Well, that's a point made.
Yeah.
Men can't be here. Then one of the sisters says, no, someone is sick or ill, we give
Yeah, that's right. So the men who come to trade, they're not allowed on the island. They meet them at the docks.
Yeah.
They do their trading, all that sort of stuff, right?
But if someone were to be shipwrecked,
it's not as though it's so separatist
that
if a man arrives and he's injured or sick, they'll go, well, you must die because we can't have men.
One thing wasn't clear to me, and you can clarify, is when Marisi goes out to her home essentially and sets up a school, because that's the point, will boys be allowed to go?
I assume it would, because the idea of the order is to deliver knowledge to the outside world. So because they do a lot of knowledge building on the island, right? They do a lot of scientific experiments. They do a lot of research. They do a lot of, I'm not sure, obviously they're just on an island. They can't research everything. But, you know, their idea is to send people back out into the world. And part of their mission, I would assume, especially in the world that has been hinted at in this book, would be to elevate the position of girls and women, especially in communities where they are oppressed or worse. And I doubt anyone gets sent back to those communities. Like, Jay is never going to get sent back to where she came from to teach stuff because...
No, I didn't get that impression. I thought that could be on the cards. The mother says it's not meant to be easy.
It's not meant to be easy. I don't think they would send a girl back to certain death. Like, Jay is going back to her community, but her community is not... Her community is quite separate. We know
you mean
Maresi's,
going
back to her.
Yes, we know it's a much nicer.
Yeah.
The only reason she's at the island is because they couldn't afford to feed her.
That's right. It was a very poor family. They had a few bad winters. Her sister, one of her
sisters. I think one of the most affecting parts of the book is when she says, if we'd only known about nutrition, I could have saved my sister. It's actually quite emotional.
And that's it. And this is the idea.
And that's why she wants to go back, to teach them those basics.
And the sisters say this, we're not about hoarding knowledge for ourselves.
Yes.
We want to send the knowledge out.
This is one of the things I loved about the book. I know we've gone sort of away from the feminist side, but one of the things I loved is that there's a library and you can read whatever you like. There is no limitations. You can be taught, first of all, teach how to read and you can read. The only thing is there are some scrolls that are very brittle and are written also in the old Eastern language. And
so
you're
not touching them without the supervision
Correct.
Of the sisters.
But that's fair. That's fair. And you have to be invited to. That's fair. But knowledge isn't often in these sort of secondary worlds.
Knowledge is hoarded.
Knowledge is hoarded. Yeah. That's not the case here. I think that's just so wonderful.
It is. And the fact that the sisters do want to disseminate what they know. They do. They want to send people back
out with
information about health and nutrition and better practices for all sorts of things.
But now that I've given that intersectional stuff, I think.
Mm.
The message of the book is about female empowerment,
yep.
But also that it's only women possibly who can do this job, that is, go out to the world and be a light upon others, that men would not be capable of doing this because of men?
I don't think the book...
Qua men, as you would say. But it doesn't say that, but there's no impression. Get the impression that... I mean, and frankly, we only get, like you were hinting at before, the men that do come are pirates and Jay's dad and...
And traders who do nothing. They just trade. They bring stuff to the island. They take blood, snail, blood, dye. They take the dyed products away.
But even they are doing... There's a transaction. They're not doing it for the love.
No, that's true.
There's a pure transaction here. So there's no... We don't get... And I'm not, this is not a critique, but we don't get an example of a man who turns up to the island who's actually there. Shit, I want to learn too. I'd like to better myself. Hey, can I come as well?
Yeah, but also I'm assuming there are male orders around the world as well.
Assuming that?
Yeah, I am assuming that because it feels based very much, with a magical twist, feels very much based on our type of a world. This island is an exception. And it's not an exception. I don't feel that it's an exception because people are going and learning stuff. It's an exception because women and girls have a safe place to go and are able to learn, unlike many parts of the rest of the world where that power is controlled by the patriarchy.
And that's all fair enough.
So, I don't feel... I see what you're saying, but I don't feel the book is saying that only women can learn stuff.
And I'm not running down the line of the horrid thing, oh, where's the men's safe space and all that sort of shit. No, clearly...
The rest of the world. It is interesting that there was one queer character in this book. It wasn't a female character.
It was a man, yes.
But it was the nephew of Jay's father.
And he's the one who's willing to, When Jay pushes her dad off the cliff, he doesn't kill her. He goes,
no, he's saying, I'll just go back and tell him you both fell off and you're both dead.
Yeah, exactly.
So what he says is like the reason he won't turn her in or kill her himself and he'll actually go back and cover for her and say, yeah, she's dead, we're done here, let's go, is because he's gay and he would be persecuted back home if it was found out he was gay. So he's oppressed.
So basically, there are no good representation of cisgender
men
in this book. That's basically...
Cisgender straight men.
Cisgender straight men. Yeah, sorry. Yes, correct.
Well, no, but it's not a story about that.
No, fair enough. I'm not attacking the book for that.
And we're assuming...
But Britt Mandela's review did... Bring that, and yes, you are so right. This idea of in the left, which the both of us will admit we are part of, that if it's not perfect, if it doesn't tick every single box,
it's rubbish. Get rid of it.
It's rubbish. And so if it doesn't play the identity card absolutely in the purest way possible,
the far right doesn't do it. The far right are more than happy to admit the failings of some of their people and some of their institutions because, hey, for the greater good, you know.
I mean, you're making a generalization there.
I'm saying that this is the patterns that I see. I see people on the far right more than willing to make allowances, whereas a lot of us on the left are like, no, you have to be perfect.
And it comes to that fine line of
and we don't Brit's, get perfection. None of us get perfection.
No, you're right. This is not a podcast about Brit's review because it's very, very even-handed.
I will link to that in the notes.
It's a very even-handed review, but when you raise that as a critique of the book, which is a fair thing to do,
and it is a critique.
I always wonder what is that because people will focus like we've just done for the last 20 minutes focus on that rather than the positives.
Look, here's the thing for me. If this was okay, I am making allowances. Allowances isn't quite the right word. I'm giving this book a bit more free rein because it is a book aimed at children. If this was a book aimed at adults and these were all adult characters and the narrator was a woman in her 20s or 30s and everything else was exactly the same, I would be a lot less forgiving of that because when you're writing for like 10 and 12 year olds, you cannot be as complex as you should be when you're writing for adults. So some of the fact that there's not a lot of friction between the girls and everything is really like happy and idyllic.
And that no one dies.
And that no one dies at the end. And even the woman who is, I mean, there's a threat of because the men do come on the ship and they do bail up the women.
They rape her.
But there's a threat that they're going to rape them all, including the girls, like the young girls, right? And instead, the sister who is the manifestation or the representative of the maiden aspect of the goddess actually becomes inhabited by the goddess. And that's, like, again, that's a step away. It's not like that sister herself volunteers to be gang raped, so all of the girls. It's actually the goddess who comes through her and possesses her and, in effect, allows that sister to not have that experience.
Yes.
So even that, like this, no one dies. No one is actually.
None of the sisters. None die. Of the pirates do.
The pirates do. But none of the girls or the sisters in the abbey. None of our people die or are hurt or and even the sister who's raped. It's not really her being raped. And then we find out in one of the codas that she actually was, she became pregnant and she had a little girl. It would have been much more interesting if that baby was a boy.
Yes.
I thought that would have been a really interesting end for her child to be a boy and people going, what happens now?
Yes.
Because this is the problem in separatist communities. You can't choose the gender of your kid. So what happens when you have a son? It's like, oh, I have a friend who actually grew up in a gender separatist household and her brother were split apart. When they were preteens, like just pre-adolescence, and she remained and lived with her mother, and her brother went and lived with the father, and that was because it was gender separate.
Which gives it all.
So it would have that would have been, but anyway,
it gives it all a sense of tweeness.
Right, and this is what I'm saying. I'm willing to like
forgive it.
Forgive a lot of that because of the overall. Strengths of the
you know
book.
Why? Because you have in the center of that book,
I would not be willing to forgive
because you have in the center of that book this enormously emotional, powerful scene between two young girls describing, well, especially one of them describing what she went through.
Yeah,
and it's horrible and awful, and it's not censored in any way. It is just it's not gory, but it's terrible, and it's two young girls discussing this and finding support in each other.
Yeah,
and just for that alone, you forgive whatever you know the possible tweeness of it or whatever.
Yeah,
you forgive all that because that. That's critical. That's important. Yeah. We can't throw that away because it doesn't tick every box.
And that's what I'm saying. And like it's an important book and the feminist themes in it are important themes. And all I'm saying is that I'm allowing it its lack of nuance in a lot of ways because of the targeted readership that I wouldn't be willing to kind of put up with without a lot more foot stomping if this was a book written about adults or even late teenagers for a late teenager adult readership. Yep. I'd be going, this is too simplistic. You're ignoring too much. But when you're writing for 10 or 12 year olds, you'd start a bit simpler and you hope that the kids who read these types of books and are receptive to this will, as they mature, develop more complexity in their thinking and their view of the world. And they will, you know, if they're not already transgendered kids or queer kids, they will know kids who are. And this is kind of like a gateway book, I guess, to that sort of
stuff.
And look,
I do understand the view of I am a 10 or 12 year old and I don't identify as my biological sex.
Mm.
So,
and where do I, if I read
so
this
if
book,
I read
where
this,
do I fit?
Where do I fit?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I don't know where I fit here.
Absolutely.
Well, let's put aside the boys who might think that, you know, the cisgender boys who think that.
Oh, a book about girls.
The one who, a boy who.
No, if you are a transgendered child.
Yeah, where do I fit?
And you
fit
read
this
book, where do you fit? If you're a queer girl.
Because the only
if you're
way
just
these,
beginning,
because the only way these characters survive is because of the blood mix between three women that are in. Stanciations of a god.
Yeah, and we know now that gender identity and ideas about what your sexuality might be begin in early childhood.
Yes,
they're not something that happens when you're about 15, 16, you suddenly look around and go, ooh, something doesn't feel like everybody else looks. So we know this begins early. So there will be children who read this book and don't feel like they're represented. So, I mean, it is an issue. I'm not saying it's not, and I will read that review and link to it. All I'm saying is that, I'm just a little bit willing to maybe be a bit more forgiving while still accepting that it is the genuine criticisms. And as I said, if nothing else, it would have been really interesting if the baby that was born on the island was a boy.
So I think there's a few things we have to do here. Mm. Actually, one main thing is that when people raise these criticisms, we don't crack the shits.
No.
So when Anita Sarkeesian says, yay, 13th Doctor, but this isn't the final answer. Yay, 13th Doctor is a female, but this isn't the be-all and end-all. Mm-hmm. We don't go, oh, she hates it because she's condemning it because the Doctor wasn't in a wheelchair and wasn't black or something. I mean, that's not what she was saying. I know how it can be read that way, and that's the problem. There's the knee-jerk on both sides. The knee-jerk to the need for perfection, and then when, because not all the boxes are ticked, and then when someone actually just raises that as a critique, as in, oh, this could have ticked this box, but it didn't, and we go, oh, well, you just... Blah, blah, blah. It's both ways. It's accepting that that critique is about there. It's not to turn a blind eye.
And there's kind of two dynamic... Well, I guess they're related dynamics at play here, and... Look, it's really hard on the internet, and we all know that. But there's a thing where you have to allow people to be happy about something, and you can't assume that because they're happy about something, they're overlooking anything else that might be wrong. So you need to allow people to go, yay, 13th Doctor's a woman, that's awesome. And you can't assume that, A, they're ignoring the stuff which still could have some improvement. Right? Someone being happy about one thing doesn't mean they disagree with the other things that other people are saying could still be wrong. So there's that.
Yes, it's astonishing that. Yeah, you're so right. Yeah.
Because we do that. It's like, yeah, this is a great thing. Oh, yes. But what? I still remember when Julia Gillard gave her famous misogyny speech.
Yep.
I will not be lectured about misogyny by that man.
Yeah.
And it was a great speech. And anyone who's not already seen that speech or read a transcript, I might dig it up on YouTube. I'm sure it's on YouTube, and link to that in the show notes as well. But, you know, and quite rightly, well, a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of people on Twitter and Facebook going, yay, fantastic, about time someone said it and the Prime Minister said it and yay. And, you know, I saw a couple of people going, oh, yeah, but she's still against gay marriage. And they're right. They're absolutely right, and she was, and it was a major failing of her political career and her prime ministership that she argued against marriage equality for a woman who was not even married, or you know, she has a partner, full-time de facto partner who she's, for all intents and purposes, in a marriage-like relationship with.
Yep.
So she's not even defending an institution she herself has partaken of, and yet, but anyway, major failing of her prime ministership and... Absolutely. Not the only one, but a major one. But all of us who are going, yay, misogyny speech, yay, brilliant, that doesn't mean that we're going, everything about Julia is fantastic.
Yes.
But there's a, you know...
That doesn't mean that we now need the internet to lecture us and do one of those. But we need to talk about Julia Gillard's misogyny... Because you know those ones that
we need to talk about.
Fuck, I hate those articles. But
yeah.
But you're right, because you're assuming that we haven't... That we're so simple in our minds that we can't have more than one concept in our head at any one time.
Yeah.
And that we can't say yay for this, knowing, without and expressing it necessarily, that there are other old problems.
And the fact that sometimes it's just nice to let people be happy for 5 minutes before you start going, yes, but actually. And the other related thing is that I also see happen a lot is you'll get people who say, but you know, it's still not very, Marici's still not very intersectional and it's very gender essentialist and very, you know, biologically determined. And and everyone goes, oh, you hate that book.
Yeah, that's right. That's the other side.
So we also can't assume that just because someone is critical of something, it means they hate everything about it and correct. They're the enemy. It's like people are allowed to be uncomplicatedly happy about something and still acknowledge and accept and agree with other criticisms.
Correct.
But they're allowed to express for 5 minutes
an
uncomplicated joy.
The world, if people listen to what you just said in the last 5 minutes, the world and the internet would be an astonishingly good place. And it probably would crumble on itself. It would probably, it wouldn't be able to exist.
The internet does not, so nature...
Everything is binary. Everything has to be binary on the internet.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
Yes.
The internet abhors nuance.
Yes.
It absolutely
does. That's right. Everything is binary. It's one or zero. You either agree or disagree.
And I don't know how that problem gets solved.
We can't solve it today.
We can't.
We will never solve it.
But anyway,
that's actually a really powerful point.
We just segued so far away from...
But no, I'm also sounding real disingenuous. That was no, because Marici... No, because no, you know what it is? Good writing and a really smart review, which you haven't read, but that's all right. Create good conversation. Yeah. That's what they're about. That's what this podcast is about.
But from what you've said, like, I completely agree. And the book does fall down there. And it is a very... It is an older type of feminism. It is second wave feminism. It is 1970s feminism. It's not intersectional. It's kind of gender essentialist. And I get all of that, and it's absolutely correct. And I would take, you know, you keep that in mind when you read the book. But there's also really good things about
And on a final point, because City of Woven Streets, we're now picking differences in these books. City of Woven Streets.
Well, they're not the same book.
No, fair enough. City of, well, no, it's good. We started by saying they're identical, and now I'm picking a difference. City of Woven Streets has more diverse cast as well, because our main characters, the brother and sister, are not people of, they're people of colour. So whereas I don't know what, it's not really explained in Marisa what.
There's, apart from Jay who comes, there's not a lot of physical description.
No, there isn't. So
the
it's not.
Oh, there's another, I think the Rose is blonde.
Yes.
Like, and that was a bit like, oh, the and the Rose, who's the maiden, the maiden aspect of the goddess, is she needs to be really, really beautiful. And her personification of the goddess makes her even more so. So it was a little bit uncomfortable that she was described as pale and blonde. And it was like,
so the point I'm making, which is possibly not the best point I've ever made, but I think City of Woven Streets does tick off more boxes in that sense. That, but I just didn't like it as much as a book. I like Marisi a lot more, but it is does have problems around that side of the...
And you know, and for a lot of readers, they will be insurmountable problems.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I completely support anyone who reads this book and goes, it's too...
For the whatever many of you listen to this podcast, we'd like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a good point to end. I'm cutting you off.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're actually kind of running on time, so that's cool.
I have to go and buy some bee stings.
I'll come with you.
Again?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, see, I'm a bit cross with you because you're a bit late today.
I did come a bit.
I didn't actually get to go. There was a rally for marriage equality in at Trades Hall.
Oh my God,
Ballarat.
You're blaming me for
that. But it's in 5 minutes and I'm no way going to get there now.
You are so... Well, why didn't you...
Well, I'm not, no, because if we wrapped up by 12:30, I could ask you to drive me into town and I could get there, but it's way too late. Anyway.
Next episode. Is our alt history episode.
Yes.
Although... Exit West, not really.
You said it was.
Well, sort of. Well, it is. Well, you'll just have to read it and see.
Okay.
Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, which is...
I've been meaning to read that since it came out, so...
Expect to see it on the Man Booker long list. I'd be surprised if it's not on the...
Very much looking forward to reading that.
Man Booker long list. And Exit West by Mohsen Hamid.
Yes, which you've recommended, so...
Yes, it's... I don't know if it's alt history, but...
You said it would... Okay, maybe it's not alt history, just you said it would pair very well
it
with...
No. Okay. For the issues that they tackle, they both pair very well together.
Okay, so I've maybe mistitled the theme.
And I think... and I actually think both could be both on the long list for the Man Booker.
Cool,
Know about, because that comes out on July 27th, and we're talking about these books next month.
Ah, interesting.
Know about that, to see if I'm right. So okay. I'm saying it here. Please send feedback by commenting at the website writerandcritic.podbean.com. Send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com. I find I don't enunciate so much on this podcast. I do listen from time to time.
Right.
My words, I speak too fast and
I laugh
garble.
Too much.
Do it now.
No, I mean I laugh talk too much.
No, I'm saying do it now.
Do what now?
Laugh talk.
No.
Hey! Or you can follow at Writer and Critic on Twitter.
I hate you.
And sponsor us on Patreon if you can. Thank you very much for listening. It's been wonderful. And for those of you who are going to Worldcon,
have an awesome time.
And listen to this podcast while you're there. And if Emmy or Maria are present, tell them we spoke about their books. No, don't tell them that.
Don't tell them.
No, well, mate.
That's a lot of pressure.
I know. Anyway, have fun.
Have fun. Bye, everyone.
Bye. You shouldn't edit out the awkwardness. It's part of the flavour.
This is getting really meta because every time I do the edits, and this will go too, by the way, I don't even know why I'm saying it. Every time I do the edits, the most bits that I'm editing out are me saying, I'll edit that out. And you're saying, no, don't edit it out. I've got all these little cuttings of you just going, no, don't edit that out. I should put together like a supercut of Ian just going, don't edit that out. Leave that one. No, don't edit it. Please don't edit it. I could fill in the other half of our conversation.
Oh, brilliant.
I could just have my part and then all your bits would just be, don't edit that out.
Don't edit that out.